Welcome back to Canada's new Medical Law Matters podcast. This is part two of my conversation with Dr. Zoe Fritz on advanced care planning. In this episode, we're going to go beyond the basics and look into the RESPECT process, real-life case examples, and how advanced care planning can benefit not just the patients, but also their families and clinicians. Dr. Fritz also shares her insights on the ethical challenges surrounding this important topic. If you're just joining us, we recommend listening to part one first. And before we dive in, don't forget to follow us on your favorite podcast platform like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also sign up for our newsletter to stay informed about upcoming episodes and exclusive content. Now, let's continue with the conversation. Which leads me nicely to the next point, which is it's for discussion around when should these conversations take place, with whom, and what should be discussed within those conversations around the what does the future look like? What does future treatment look like? What is it like to be an intensive care patient? All of these things that people don't know unless they've experienced it through a loved one. So first of all, when do you think ideally these advanced care planning conversations should take place?
So I think I'm going to say again that I think although there may be an ideal time, the most important thing is that they do take place. So I think people shouldn't be scared of at least starting the conversation with their GP, with specialist, with their family, anyone. But I would say the ideal person is someone who knows the patient and who knows their condition. And that will be different for different people. So if it's someone with motor neuron disease, it's going to be their neurologist or maybe their neurology specialist, their MND specialist nurse might be the best person to have the conversation with them. I've worked with lots of colleagues and we've developed an approach which is not perfect and still needs iterations. But I think it is a very good way of starting these conversations. And it's called the RESPECT process, the Recommended Summary Plan for Emergency Care and Treatment. And it's looked after by the Resus Council UK. And it's used across much of England and a bit of Scotland. And hopefully it's going all the way across Northern Ireland shortly. So it is a very widely used approach for anyone listening on the podcast in the UK. And there is interest internationally as well. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the RESPECT process because I use a lot of evidence to try and see how we can have a process that will nudge patients, clinicians into a conversation that will make sure that things are documented in a way that is easily recognizable in an emergency, but which is sensitive to patients' needs and expectations. So as I say, RESPECT stands for Recommended Summary Plan for Emergency Care and Treatment. And I always say it was my kind of, the acronym was my eureka moment. Other scientists have their eureka moment in a lab, but I was like, this is about respecting patient preferences and respecting clinical judgment. So it's about making sure we understand both sides of those things. So it's all about shared understanding. And it starts off, the only way I think you can start having this conversation is by making sure that the patient and the clinician has a shared understanding of the patient's current situation and their prognosis and what to expect in the future. So for example, if a patient has a lung cancer that they've been told needs palliative chemotherapy, that means they're going to die from their lung cancer. But sometimes that hasn't been understood by the patient or expressed carefully enough by the doctor. They've said palliative chemotherapy as like a proxy for, we can't cure you, this is palliative. But the patient hasn't really heard that. And if you start off having a conversation about what treatments you may or may not want, or CPR, to a patient who hasn't really understood, because it hasn't been communicated well enough to them, what their disease is and what their prognosis is, then you can't have an advanced care planning conversation without a shared understanding of the patient's current situation. And I go back to that lady I mentioned to you that said to me, I'm fine so long as I have the sun on my face and I can listen to music. That's a shared understanding to the doctor as well about what their quality of life is like at that moment and how they're valuing it. So it's shared understanding of the patient's current situation. And then you establish a shared understanding of what the patient values and fears. And to me, this is the most important bit to write down in an advanced care planning document and in RESPECT. So it is about what health outcomes the patient most values and what they most fear in their own words. So that might be, I had someone last week who said, I want to have my marbles. I want to be neurologically intact. I have other people, and we can talk about this legally, who say, I don't want to be a burden on my family. And some people say that that's a problem, that we shouldn't be worried about people being a burden on family. But I actually think it's something that should be respected so long as there isn't people putting undue pressure on them. Some people really value the independence and not feeling that they're weighing people down. And that is a reasonable thing to wish for, that they want to live their life independently and go without burdening their family. Often, and I've had a lot of patients talk to me about this, it's because they themselves looked after dying parents for a long time, and they felt that it changed their relationship with their parent, and they don't want to repeat that. Anyway, so you write down what the patient most values, what the patient most fears, in their own words. And then based on that, the clinician can make recommendations about what treatments they think would get them to the place they most value and stop them getting to a place that they fear. And that includes a recommendation about CPR. So the whole work on respect came from problems with the way that DNA CPRs, which are in a way a kind of advanced care planning, but they were a very blunt instrument. They were one form to give guidance to clinicians in the event of someone's heart stopping as to whether or not the heart should be restarted. So a recommendation about CPR is included in that section of clinical recommendations. And then there's sections for documenting capacity, because obviously if the patient doesn't have capacity, then you need to talk to those close to them and you need to assess their capacity properly, and a space to write down anyone who is involved in the conversation, and actually a space for the patient or their relatives to sign. And this comes back to that conversation we were having earlier about advanced care planning being quite helpful for the relatives and for the doctor. So it allows the patient, if they want to sign, to be able to show that they were involved in that conversation. It's actually very rare for patients to want to sign. We don't prompt it. It's only if the patient wants to. I don't think patients particularly, they don't seek it out, but it's there if anyone wants it. So that's the process. You asked when the best time was. So that process happens at different trigger points. So in our hospital in Cambridge, we will have that discussion, that respect discussion, with pretty much everybody who comes into hospital. Obviously, if they're completely well, we don't necessarily go through all of those. I mean, we don't anticipate, if we anticipate like a short 2-day admission and them going home, we don't go through all of that. We just write that they would like to have all treatments. But it is a trigger when you come into hospital, because it is, you might get sicker. Other triggers, there's a fantastic approach at Papworth just next to us, where the cardiothoracic surgeons send out a patient information sheet before surgery to the patient. And they get the patient to think, I mean, obviously most surgery goes well, but you're opening up someone's heart, things can go wrong. And it's really important to know what that person would want before they end up on the intensive care unit, having lots of treatments, that they've talked about it with their family. So they get a specialist nurse to talk with the patient, and then they go over it as kind of part of the consent process. And I think actually respect should be part of the consent process for any significant operation, because the operation is not just about the operation, it's about the postoperative period. In clinic, so as I said, someone with motor neuron disease, someone with COPD, someone with heart failure, someone with MS, any chronic and progressive conditions are conditions that you should really be thinking about what the future is going to look like and what you want. And then I think another time is just as you get older and frailer, you need to think again about what would you like if you were going into a nursing home, in what context, you know, it can extend, in what context would you want to be taken into hospital? Do you just want to be treated, you know, do you want to be treated in the nursing home? Do you not want any extreme measures unless, obviously, for example, you fell and broke a hip and the only place that could be treated was hospital. So the respect process allows you to think across all those things in different settings.
Thank you. I was going to ask you specifically about respect, but it's even better that it just naturally came in. The other thing, I suppose, in terms of timing, and you mentioned, you know, as someone gets more frailer, do you think there ought to be a policy in place for perhaps GPs, a trigger whereby when a patient of theirs gets to a certain age, and I know age isn't necessarily the trigger point, but if they haven't already had the discussion for other reasons, if they get to a certain age, they should be invited in for a conversation around
the I actually planning. Don't, because I think age isn't the right thing. And I think it needs to come from the patient. So what I really would like, or the person, they might not be a patient yet. And I think that's actually the important thing, is that it might just be someone who has no health conditions at all, but is getting older, because that is what happens to all of us. What I would really like to see is a public engagement campaign about advanced care planning and about respect. And Australia, for example, has done that. And then we're in a world where GPs are very stretched at the moment. So this is, you know, this is something perhaps down the line, but having the GPs be properly trained to have these conversations, as many of them have been, and many of them are doing very well, but for them to have the capacity to have the conversation, but for it to be patient initiated. So for us to say, everybody should be having a respect conversation, for us to say, or whatever, advanced care planning, I'm on respect, I'm team respect, but advanced care planning in whatever guise it takes, everyone should be doing that. And you can make an appointment with your GP for an advanced care planning or respect conversation. And the GPs should be prepared to do that. But I don't think they should be calling people in. And the reason for that is, I think people will feel like, well, what's happened? Why has this tipping point happened now? Why was I not thinking about it before? So I think if you or I wanted a respect conversation, we should be able to make that appointment. You could say that, you know, you could send the information out to the whole population saying, when you're ready, this is something that's available to you. You could say that we could be, you know, having it on the Arches. So you could have it on EastEnders, you could have it on the Arches, you could have letters through the post, you could have a media campaign, any number of things so that people know this is something where they can have some agency, where they can show what it is they want, and that doctors are prepared to have those conversations with them.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's interesting, there are some aspects in life where people will be quite explicit around their thoughts and wishes and feelings. And the example I can think of is in maternity, where a pregnant woman will be encouraged to, or perhaps they'll just do it themselves, create a birth plan. And that birth plan sets out in intricate detail sometimes everything they want to have in relation to their labor. It doesn't always happen
Important point. But, so I think there is a danger. And one of the reasons that I am such an evangelist about respect is because it is both taking into account what your overall preferences are, but also what is clinically possible and likely to be a benefit. And I actually think with a lot of the birth plans, and now I am definitely treading on territory that I'm not as familiar with. I've had two children myself. I did obs and gynae at med school, but I have not done any obs and gynae otherwise. Is that those birth plans become very detailed and not manageable, and also sometimes put the wrong priorities. So people become fixated on, and I'm not talking about the women, I'm talking about everybody, become fixed on, well, this person wanted X during their birth plan. Actually, the thing that every woman wants is a healthy delivered baby and a healthy mum, right? Those are the two outcomes that everybody wants. And I think sometimes we can get distracted. And unfortunately, at the moment, we've seen that there are real problems in maternity services. And I do wonder whether we've lost track a bit. So with an advanced care plan, I think it's really important that we don't become fixated on, I want this music at the time that I die. And we make sure that we think about what are the things that we, you know, sure, great, we should have music, whatever music we want at the time that we die. Absolutely. That's worth writing out somewhere. Probably not an essential part of the emergency plan, but somewhere. But we shouldn't become fixated on that. We need to make sure we keep the big picture.
And there's a couple of things. I know you mentioned about the burdens on the family, and we'll talk about that in a sec. But just carrying on from the probably tortured analogy of the birth plan, I think one of the things that you're alluding to there is the almost, I don't know if it's ignorance or just lack of knowledge of what, in the case of maternity, what giving birth might be like for that person. And let's move away from the birth plan now. But in a context of, let's say someone, the Papworth example, or someone who's been recommended surgery, and there's a discussion around the surgery and the surgeon themselves, and it's amazing that Papworth have gone beyond this now, but some surgeons will give very good detail in a consent discussion about the surgery and what's why they're recommending it, what the risks and benefits are. Hopefully they'll also discuss the risks and benefits of alternative treatments and no treatment. But as you say, they rarely talk about the possibility of having to go to intensive care, unless perhaps it's open heart surgery or it's something that's anticipated.
Well, I think they often mention it, but what they don't mention is, as in they have to mention it. That is one of the risks. And it's you know, but I don't think they really talk about what the patient would want in the event of things going badly, as in they list it as a risk, but they don't then think about what the patient would want in those events.
Yeah, I know. I've just taken that further. I think they don't necessarily explain to the patient quite what it means to be in intensive care. And I just wanted to explore that a bit more, because when we're talking about future planning, so discussing with a patient what they will or won't want in the event that X happens, how much detail do you think needs to be gone into around, for example, intensive care, what it is actually like to be in an intensive care ward, to have the beeps going on all the time, to be have your observations checked, to be on a ventilator, all of these things that don't really come up.
No, that's an excellent question. And in the UK, you're absolutely right. You can't know what an ICU really is like unless you've been on one. And I don't think we do a very good job at teaching people what it is. You know, there aren't really good consent videos for ICU. We've talked about making them actually in the past. It is quite hard to convey exactly what it means. And it's also back to this risk appetite. Some people come off ICU and are fine. Most people come off ICU and have a long period of recovery after. And quite a lot of people come off ICU and never go back to work. So it's not just the ICU, it's the ICU and what follows. I'm using going back to work as a proxy for, you know, returning to their usual life. So I don't think we, the short answer is, I don't think we consent people properly for ICU. The longer answer is, there's some facts that we can give, but there's also just some information that it's very hard to ascertain. Interestingly, I'm painting ICU to be miserable, but there are plenty of people who've been to ICU once, for example, with COPD, and who are very happy to go back again. So it is not that once you've been to ICU, you never want to go there again. I want to make that clear. It is a place where magic happens and people get brought, you know, get rescued.
So, and Zoe, just taking it further, you mentioned just general ICU admissions and an ignorance around that. But as I understand it, there is also some study in America looking at the number of people who survive or don't survive CPR on TV episodes.
The study in the States I loved because it actually got New England Journal of Medicine, which is an amazing output. And it was a team of dedicated doctors watched all the episodes of three series of different medical dramas. And it was a 60% success rate from CPR on the medical drama. Whereas in real life, it's 15% success rate in those in whom CPR is attempted. And you need to remember that 80% of patients who die in hospital die with a recommendation not to attempt CPR. So that 15% success rate is 15% success on those who we think are going to survive it. If you start looking at the survival rate from people who, for example, have significant heart failure or who have frailty and not much muscle mass, it's less than 1%. So yes, the TV portrayals, which is obviously where a lot of us get our even subconscious information from, are not accurate. Because a patient can't demand a treatment, and I actually am not loving the language demand, you can maybe correct me on it, but since I don't know what the language was in Burke, but they can't request a treatment that a doctor doesn't think will be of benefit to them. So if you go up to a patient and say, would you like CPR in the same way that you might say, would you like fish and chips for lunch? Then it's quite hard for the patient to be able to have any perspective on A, what CPR means, and B, that if they ask for it, we might say, well, actually, no, you can't have it. So that's a terrible way to set up a CPR conversation. And I get very cross with my colleagues when I hear someone saying, since Tracy, we have to ask him, the law says we need to ask you if you'd like to be for CPR. That's not what the law says. The law says that, as I think, and Rob again, where this is a good double act, we must consult a patient about the decision about whether or not to attempt CPR. So one of the reasons I think respect is so important is because in order to have a conversation about CPR, you need to have established shared understanding with the patient and actually shared trust with the patient about the patient's condition and about what they most value. And then you as a clinician are making a recommendation about whether or not CPR would benefit them. You check and you say, are you comfortable with that recommendation?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it follows the Tracy decision, which was, as you know, was a Cambridge University Hospital case. And just for the listeners, the case concerned a patient who in that case, the arguments were that full discussions weren't had with the patient and the patient or the relatives weren't fully aware of the fact that the doctors had decided that they wouldn't be providing CPR in the event that their patient needed to be resuscitated. And so out of that case, as you say, Zoe, it was a Court of Appeal case that came the rule, the law that conversations must be had, i.e. the clinicians must let the patient know that in the circumstances where they won't be providing resuscitation, and if the patient doesn't have capacity, then it's the conversations need to be had with the relatives around that.
There is a caveat. There is a caveat to it, though, which I think is important. So the caveat was, unless you think it will cause physiological or psychological harm. I've had a conversation with a colleague in the last few weeks who called me about a patient who didn't want to have a conversation about CPR, who was dying, and whose family felt that they wouldn't benefit from CPR. But the patient had capacity, and my colleague felt that the law was asking him to have that conversation, even though it was clearly causing her harm. He felt it was causing her harm. And he phoned me as kind of ethics on call. I'm unofficially ethics on call in my hospital to see about this. And I said, I actually sent him the part of the judgment, and I said, I would write in the notes that you think this is going to cause her psychological harm, and that you've had a conversation with the family and you are now making a best interest decision. And I think it's actually pretty important for us not to think that the law means we must have a conversation with the patient about CPR, even if they don't want to. Sure, we shouldn't shy away from doing it if we think it's going to cause them a bit of distress, because actually, going back to our whole advanced care planning conversation, this might be a lever for them to be thinking about the future and about what they want in the future. And we need to be honest with them about what we're anticipating. But if they're clear they don't want to have the conversation, we don't need to bang them over the head with it.
Yeah, agreed. And you mentioned the word distress there, and that comes up in the judgment, doesn't it? The distinction between distress and harm. And I think most people would be distressed by having that conversation. But to go over the hurdle from distress to psychological or physiological harm is not a, I don't know how big a leap it is. I suppose it depends on each individual patient. But as you say, if there is that patient and the clinician is, or the relatives are satisfied, they would go over that hurdle by having that conversation. Then as you say, you don't need to have it. And in fact, you shouldn't have it. The earlier you mentioned, Zoe, the sort of going back to best interest discussions and what would be helpful to put in an advanced care plan document. And you mentioned burdens on a patient who doesn't want to be a burden on their relatives. And I think that's really important, because I mean, I've dealt with cases. In fact, we've had a case together where a patient has said that or has indicated that, and the relatives have sort of almost either disagreed or shied away from that point because, well, there may be many reasons why they might shy away, because, you know, that they're the loved ones and they would want to disregard that, because they would say, well, you're not going to be a burden on us, we'll do anything for you. But I think it's very important to distinguish sometimes between a patient's best interests and what the relative's best interests are. And of course, the law is very much focused on the patient's best interests, and they do sometimes overlap. And, you know, I've certainly seen cases where, and in fact, maybe they always overlap, but I've seen situations where a patient has made it quite clear that they don't want to be a burden on their family, but it's the family who've been asked, because let's say they have a lasting power of attorney, they've been asked to make that decision. And there's almost a conflict there, because the family member is saying, well, you're not going to be a burden on me or us, but the patient has very much decided
that
they will
be. So I wonder if the language needs to be a bit different. So I wonder if it needs to be, instead of, I guess when you say, I don't want to be a burden, it is making the assumption that the family will find it burdensome to look after them. And that's what the family's pushing back on. Whereas if the individual says, I don't want to be dependent, I want my independence. And if I'm in a state where I'm dependent on my family to look after me, that is something I fear. So you know, maybe we need to make sure that we're careful in not projecting or not documenting in such a way that projects things on family members. I have had conversations with people that absolutely make it clear that that is not how they want to end their days. They just don't want to be in a position of, and actually maybe people don't want to feel beholden or have to feel great. Like, it, obviously, we are by definition children, and so we obviously, you know, would happily look after our parents.
So Zoe, I wanted to now cover and perhaps just conclude on those situations where perhaps someone has made an advanced care plan, or perhaps they've started to, but the clinicians have been liaising with the relatives, but there's still uncertainty around patient choice. How do you deal with those situations?
Sorry, what do you mean by patient choice?
What the patient would want in the circumstance. So this is a patient who lacks capacity. Let's say, for argument's sake, they're in intensive care and they can't communicate in any way. And there is a confusion or an uncertainty over whether or not this particular patient would want to remain alive, perhaps, or remain very much dependent on others for the rest of their life. And perhaps some of the relatives, but not all of the relatives, are
so obviously it's incredibly
different
difficult
viewpoint.
when there is disagreement or discord among relatives, particularly at a time when someone's very sick and emotions are heightened and people rightly think it's their last chance. You know, it's an incredibly difficult situation for everybody. So I think being absolutely honest about that at the beginning is the first thing to do, to say this is an incredibly difficult situation, and to know exactly what the right thing to do is going to be really hard. And it may be that we need to bring other people into this. So just be straightforward about the fact that this might not be something you can solve yourselves. Try and get everybody in the room, more than one clinician. So I think it's always important to have offered a second opinion as well. So you might say that the clinicians might be saying, look, this is the prognosis. This is what we think is likely to happen. And these are the treatments we would recommend. These are the treatments we wouldn't recommend. And offer to the family a second opinion in the first instance from within the hospital, but also if they wanted it from outside of the hospital. So that the clinical recommendations at least can be the clinical understanding of the situation and prognosis at least can be consistent. So you're taking away that bit, or you're minimizing that bit of uncertainty. And then I would get everybody that is willing to get into the room in the room, be honest about the fact that it's going to be tricky, and say what we're trying to achieve is the best outcome for your family member. And what we need to understand is what is best for them. So can we talk about what we think are the things they most value and most fear, and then what we think the chances are of getting them there. And say, we might not resolve this right now. This might take several conversations. We might need a mediator. And if we can't decide as a group of family members and clinicians, then we'll have to go to the court of protection and get advice from there. Oh, I've left out a step. We can take it to the clinical ethics advisory group of our hospital and get their views as well.
Absolutely. And that is a very important step, because a lot of hospitals don't have ethics advisory groups, clinical ethics advisory groups. And I mean, I would say this because I sit on one with you, but I do think that they are an incredibly important step along the way, because they not only support the clinicians with these really challenging decisions or situations, but they also support the patients and their relatives. I suppose a call from me for more trusts to establish those groups. You mentioned the best interests, what's best for the patients. And I suppose, yeah, as you say, court of protection might be the last resort for some of these cases. And that's where I suppose we come in. But one thing we'd certainly be asking early on in our conversation is what the patient would want. And that's where these advanced care plans documents are so valuable.
Very much so. Well, I've got one other thing. We've talked about advanced care planning as a piece of paper, or often an electronic thing. And we've talked about when is the best time to have these conversations. And something else is talking about whether actually we're in a world where we have voice notes and video notes and we can record things very easily. I think that in all these situations, even if you can't manage to distill exactly what you most value and most fear in a piece of paper, if you were anticipating a situation in the future, you could record a conversation with someone that you were having where you were thinking about these things. Now, that's not going to help a doctor in an emergency making an immediate decision about whether or not to attempt CPR, but it might help someone in a situation that we're talking about on ICU when you've got a much more complicated situation. And and Rob, this hasn't been tested, an advanced decision to refuse treatment needs to be signed, dated, witnessed. But like a video note that you wrote saying, these are the things I really value. These are the things I really fear. This is what I want. This is what I don't want. Surely that would need to be, when making a best interest decision, you would absolutely need to take that into account. I mean, that would be gold dust information. So I think you're asking, when's the best time to have these conversations? I've said early, and start them and have them frequently. I'm sorry, I'm about to undo legal. I'm doing the opposite of a legal plug, because I'm going to say, don't wait for a lawyer to help you properly cast out an advanced decision to refuse treatment. If there's something you feel really strongly about, make a video note yourself and send it to people so that people know what you want.
No, I completely agree. And don't worry about casting doubt, because these going to court should really be a last resort situation, and we'd much prefer that not to be involved in a lot of these cases, because they're very, very harrowing and put a lot of undue distress on patients and clinicians. And you mentioned the frequency of these conversations, because I think it's really important also to put out there that someone shouldn't just write down some wishes and feelings and values and what they do and don't want 2 years ago and then not do anything about it and just put it in a cupboard somewhere, because things change. Not only do their views change or might develop, their condition might develop, but circumstances change, and also medical treatment might change. And what was available to them 2 years ago may not be available now, or something else may be available. So I think it's very important, as you say, to have these conversations frequently, and it being a dynamic process. And yeah, the voice notes is a great way of updating your advanced care plan so that everyone knows it. But of course, as you say, it's important that if you're going to do a voice note, you make sure that it's communicated to people and the right people, so that they can all understand and be very well aware of what is in your best interests, as opposed to having to guess what that might be. Right.
There is one thing that we talked about, the umbrella of advanced care planning. We talked about ADRTs and respect and kind of general advanced care plans. And most of those things come from the patient or are with the patient and the clinician together. But there are also things I guess patients should be aware of within hospital, which are treatment escalation plans that are written, which are the clinicians kind of thinking about what it is that would or wouldn't be of benefit to a patient. And that also comes in that umbrella and is, of course, talked about with the patient, but it's very much clinician-led in general, and it doesn't cross into the community. So I guess one of the things that we should be thinking about is, when we do advanced care planning, how does that fit across the different healthcare settings? And I think it's critical that there is some continuity among them, and not just one thing for hospital and another for at home, that we think across holistically the whole patient journey.
Oh, definitely. And it's quite a frustration of mine, because in the cases we deal with, and you know, when it does go to the Court of Protection, there is usually an incredibly detailed escalation plan, which is, because it's been ordered by a judge, shared with everyone who needs it, including the local authority, if it's someone who's, say, under safeguarding, or the care home, or and the relatives, the patient themselves, GP. But I do think, as you say, sometimes things fall down in communication between different services, and unless at the moment, unless the court is involved. And I suppose that's a bit of a healthcare inequality, isn't it? But wouldn't it be great if there was much more shared communication and understanding between in-hospital care and primary care and care homes, etc., so that when these escalation plans, treatment plans, whatever they are produced and adapted and updated, everyone is aware of them.
Excellent. Thank you.
So that concludes part two of our deep dive into advanced care planning. If you've enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're tuning in from. And make sure you subscribe to our newsletter for the latest updates. Thank you for listening to Medical Law Matters podcasts. We'll be back soon with more expert insights to help you navigate the healthcare landscape. And I'm very pleased to say that I'll be speaking next time with Dr. Anna Conway Morris, who is a consultant psychiatrist specializing in eating disorders, and we'll be discussing the really tricky area of mental health law and mental capacity law in relation to treating people with eating disorders. Hope you can listen then.